are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 2016-2017, while working for the USA Today's Network's Wisconsin investigative team, author John Ferrick wrote dozens of articles examining the murder case against Stephen Avery, who had already beaten one wrongful conviction, only to be charged again with the murder of Teresa Halbach in 2005. This case captured global attention through the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer. In this anniversary edition of Wrecking Crew, demolishing the case against Stephen Avery, Ferrick not only lays out in meticulous detail the post-conviction strategy of Kathleen Zellner, the high-profile, high-octane lawyer fighting to free Avery, but also includes a new 5 years later section. This update provides fresh insights and developments in Avery's ongoing legal battle. Additionally, this special edition features an exclusive epilogue, a November 2023 interview with Stephen Avery. For this book, Zellner, arguably America's most successful wrongful conviction attorney, granted Ferrick unprecedented access to the exhaustive pro bono efforts she and her small suburban Chicago law firm have invested in a man she believes to be wrongfully ensnared by Manitowoc County's unscrupulous justice system. This anniversary edition offers new revelations and a comprehensive look at a case that continues to stir public debate and demand justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery, with my special guest investigative journalist and author, John Ferrick. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview. Welcome back, John Ferrick.
Thanks for having me again, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for this, for coming on and talking about Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery. Let's talk about this updated fifth anniversary edition, including exclusive interview with Stephen Avery. Let's go back to the reason for the updated version, what's included in this updated version before we get down to the details.
Well, with the updated version here, and again, it's been 5 years since Wrecking Crew had come out, and also, ironically, 5 years since the last season two for Making a Murderer that came out in October of 2018, and then the Wrecking Crew update the following month, November of 2018. And there had been a number of developments over the last 5 years, really in the last couple of years. And that's what motivated me and Wild Blue Press to really want to push forward, Dan, with this update version here. One of the key facts that came forward after my book and after Making Murderer, just totally out of nowhere, was the discovery of an eyewitness who actually was a newspaper delivery driver. And he had seen information pointing to an alternative suspect, somebody other than Stephen Avery, that may have been involved in Teresa Halbach's murder, but certainly was involved, instrumental in having access and handling her vehicle in the hours before that vehicle was discovered, which was a couple days, I should say several days after she had already gone missing. That's a key component of the book update for Wrecking Crew. There was also a case, a defamation lawsuit out of Making a Murderer by one of the Manitowoc County Sheriff's deputies who was a central figure in Making a Murderer season one and two. And he filed a federal lawsuit against producers and against Netflix. And that case finally worked its way through the court system over these last several years. And a decision was made whether or not Making a Murderer was involved in committing defamation against a sheriff's official. So that was a key update in the book as well. And another important point of the book was just having access to Stephen Avery through his attorney, Kathleen Zellner, and being able to do a lengthy interview with him to kind of find out where he's at mentally and physically in prison right now. And, you know, what's going through his mind? What kind of hopes? Does he still have hopes of getting out? Has he been distraught, angry, frustrated, the fact that he hasn't gotten out in light of all the efforts by Kathleen Zellner to uncover evidence pointing to alternative suspects? uncover evidence, you know, of evidence being fabricated or tampered with by the sheriff's officials and the prosecution possibly withholding evidence that could have been exculpatory for he and his lawyers for the original trial. So those were all several of the key updates. I also did kind of a little bit of a human interest element of the book. There's been so many people, Dan, since Making a Murderer came out, just people all over the world that have taken an interest in the case. And so I decided to focus in on one individual who's kind of become a folk hero, folk artist on the music side of things. And he's written a couple dozen songs about the Making a Murderer case, all from the Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey's vantage point from a social justice perspective. So we kind of really drilled down one song in particular that really looked at the evidence tampering of the case and kind of examined why he wrote that song.
Let's talk it. Let's take us to the Judge Angela Sutkiewicz. And you talk about her record. You talk about Judge Willis's retirement after the case in 2016. Zellner gets involved after watching Netflix, incredibly, after being contacted by Avery. But after watching Netflix, Zellner, Kathleen Zellner, and her firm get involved after in 2016. So tell us about the bid for an appeal and this Judge Sutkiewicz.
Well, again, and just for background for everybody, Dan, I mean, Kathleen Zellner is one of the kind of the world heavyweight champions as far as being a prize fighter on the wrongful conviction movement. She's had a couple dozen very well-known high-profile cases where she's been able to get people from all walks of life, people that came from families that were well-to-do and other people that just came from the streets and really had no family. But she's taken up the crusade for people that she only takes on cases that she is 100% convinced in their innocence. She walks away from cases and has nothing to do with it if she has any hint or suspicion or belief that the person's lying to her or trying to manipulate her into believing that the person's innocent when they are in fact guilty of murder. So she's had incredible success over the last 30 plus years as a wrongful conviction lawyer. So she got involved in Stephen Avery's case literally from watching Making a Murderer, and, you know, unbeknownst to her at the time. But yeah, Stephen Avery had written her previously trying to reach out to her to consider taking up his case while he's in prison. So she's spent now, I mean, this month is, I think today or tomorrow is the anniversary. It was the first week of January, I'm pretty sure, Dan. But she took up the case in his crusade January of 2016. So 8 years now. Wow. She's been involved in his case for 8 years, which sounds like a long time, and it is a long time. But in the wrongful conviction movement, it's probably par for the course. So she's had cases that have taken her far lot longer to win. And she and her firm and her team of private investigators have put a ton of money and time and energy all on their own, researching Stephen Avery and looking at the evidence, looking at alternative suspects, looking at the original trial testimony. And so over these last 8 years, then she's uncovered what she believes is a long and strong track record that points to an alternative suspect, suspects plural, but she's really zeroed in on one individual, Dan. And also a lot of evidence that she believes was mishandled or fabricated, tampered with, or withheld from the original lawyers for Stephen Avery at the time of his trial. And again, she's put 8 years into the case so far. And in the court of a public opinion, it's probably 90 to 95% in her favor, in Stephen Avery's favor. But as we all know, it really comes down to, you know, the judge that happens to be assigned to the case. And as you mentioned, Angela Sutkiewicz had been the judge already previously assigned to Stephen Avery's case after Judge Manitowoc County Judge Patrick Willis had retired from the bench several years ago. So Judge Sutkiewicz, who's from neighboring Sheboygan County, Sheboygan's about an hour away from Manitowoc, but she was assigned the case and she's handled it over these last several years. And time after time after time after time, all of the rulings, all the post-conviction rulings that Zellner has filed and waited for a decision from Judge Sutkiewicz on whether or not she could get a new trial for Stephen Avery or just get Stephen Avery back into a courtroom to do an evidentiary hearing, which is basically a mini trial of sorts. But on every opportunity, Zellner has walked into a closed door and Judge Sutkiewicz, just time after time, always has ruled against Stephen Avery on his post-conviction appeals.
In this last hearing in front of the judge, what were the main issues that she brought up? We talked before this episode about a few people that came up, and their testimony, very interestingly, supports what Zellner and her team have put forth. And one of those is Kemen Romlev. And you talk about a text sent to Scott Tadich way back that he had seen the RAV4 at a turnabout, but he did not respond to the text from this Kemen Romlev that night. Tell us about what else Kemen Romlev does and how Kathleen Zellner gets wind of all of this.
Well, I was going to say, going back with Romlev, he was one of those individuals, Dan, that they came forward after making a murder. And like you said, he was one of those persons that he remembered going to one of the gas stations kind of on the outskirts of Manitowoc. It was actually outside of Mishicot. He was there. He remembered seeing the Teresa Halbach missing persons posters right within the short time period of her going missing. And Romlev was certain that while he was around that gas station, that he had encountered a member of the Manitowoc Sheriff's Office. And was pretty certain that it had to be, of all people, Andy Colburn, who everybody that's watched Making a Murder and is familiar with Wrecking Crew knows that he's one of the key central figures in the whole Stephen Avery case. And actually going way back to the beginning of Stephen Avery's first wrongful conviction case, when Colburn was in the early days of his sheriff's duties working in the jail. So there's a long, long, long history with Andy Colburn and Stephen Avery. And again, as you brought up with Romlev, Romlev was pretty certain that he had seen this Andy Colburn on what was probably supposed to be Andy Colburn's day off of work, and saw him nonetheless at this gas station property. And so Romlev was one of those first persons that Zellner had uncovered that really helped solidify and kind of change the narrative as far as the possibility and probability that Teresa Halbach did in fact leave Stephen Avery's property, the Avery Salvage Yard, alive on Halloween afternoon, October 31st of 2005. The narrative that Stephen Avery was convicted on at trial by Ken Kratz was that Teresa Halbach came to the Avery property early that afternoon to do a photo shoot for one of the vehicles that Avery and his family was trying to sell, and that she was murdered on the property by Stephen Avery and never left the property. Whereas Kemen Romlev is one of those key figures that comes forward and signs an affidavit, gives a statement to Zellner, testifying to the fact, Dan, that he strongly believes that he did, in fact, see Teresa Halbach's vehicle, the turquoise-colored green. Yeah, I mean, it depends on the sunlight. There was all kinds of conspiracy theories about the vehicle that Zellner and I both believe aren't true, but nonetheless, we'll just say it's a turquoise-colored RAV4, but that it was seen at this turnaround area on the outskirts of Mishicot. And so Romlev was important in at least verifying the strong possibility that Halbach did, in fact, leave the Avery property and somehow met her demise and her death off-site, whether it was by Stephen Avery or someone else.
This might be out of order, but tell us what Tom Sawinski says he saw and witnessed.
Yeah, Tom Sawinski, and that was kind of one of the key points for updating the book, Dan, because again, when I wrote Wrecking Crew 5 years ago, I didn't know who Tom Sawinski was. He had never appeared in Making a Murder season one or two. So I was really intrigued when this guy came forward because of the fact, too, it didn't seem like he came forward either for publicity's sake or for notoriety or fame or fortune at all. It was just he was somebody that insisted that he had come forward back when Teresa Halbach originally went missing. And Zellner and her investigators had a devil of a time trying to do their own research to verify his claims and insistence that he did, in fact, contact the Manitowoc Sheriff's Office back at the time that Teresa Halbach went missing, insisting that he had a tip to pass along to them. So Sawinski lives in Colorado now, and so he'd been gone from Manitowoc for several years. But at the time of Teresa Halbach disappearing, October of 2005, he was a newspaper delivery driver, ironically for the company that I previously worked for two different times, for Gannett, Wisconsin Media, which is part of the USA Today network. So he had delivered newspapers, apparently, and I had never met him. I mean, he was an hour away from where I work, but he delivered newspapers for the Manitowoc newspaper. And he came forward and gave an affidavit in the last year or two to Kathleen Zellner, testifying to the fact that he was delivering his newspapers, you know, sometime around 4:30 in the morning while most of Wisconsin was sound asleep. But that's when newspapers get delivered. And while he was delivering those newspapers, he was getting close to the Avery property, the Avery Salvage Yard. And as he got closer, he saw two people, and one was not wearing a shirt, and probably because they were sweating from, you know, the exertion. But one of the individuals he was sure was Stephen Avery's other nephew, the nephew that testified against him at the trial, the one that was the star witness for the prosecution, Dan.
Yes.
And his name was Bobby Dassey. And Sawicki was not sure about the second individual. He had some detailed descriptions about the person's character, their build, their beard, their physique, but he did not know the name at all, the second person. But nonetheless, he was sure that he saw two individuals, one being Bobby Dassey, pushing a vehicle that basically mirrored, you know, was identical to the vehicle that Teresa Halbach had. It was a RAV4 that would later turn up 5 or 6 hours later, actually about 6 hours later. That vehicle was in fact discovered on the outer edge of the Avery Salvage Yard, which anybody that's watched Making a Murder would remember that. It's a very dramatic scene and dramatic component of the actual Stephen Avery trial. A woman named Pam Sturm that was out there with her daughter and discovered the vehicle being, it was covered with a bunch of trees and branches. Basically, the sense of my message, this is, you know, how to find the vehicle rather than hiding the vehicle. But like I said, so getting back to your original question about Tom Sawicki, yeah, he came out of nowhere in the last couple of years insisting that he did in fact see, that he was an eyewitness to seeing Bobby Dassey and a second person handling, pushing the vehicle, the Teresa Halbach, the Auto Trader magazine photographer that disappeared and was murdered. And so I thought that this was a huge, you know, revelation for this case. And Zellner did as well. So she spent a considerable time researching Sawicki, probing his background, verifying that he in fact did work for Wisconsin Gannett News Media, and also tracked down his employment records, Dan, to verify that his story matched up. And then after she proved that was all true, undertook the painstaking process then, Dan, of trying to actually verify his insistence that he had, in fact, contacted the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office around the time of Teresa Halbach's disappearance, because Zellner had no police reports and she was not aware of any audio, police radio, you know, that kind of stuff that was in her possession at the time that she had contacted and spoken with Tom Sawicki as she was trying to verify his story.
What's very interesting, Kathleen Zellner is looking for all people that might be third-party people of interest, persons of interest. And then the very suspicious behavior of Ryan Hilgalis, and the Teresa's roommate as well, as you say, providing, seemed like, direction, a camera, and a phone number to the sheriff in case they found something in their search, Pam Sturm and her companion. So very suspicious behavior that Kathleen Zellner has to consider as well when you're looking for somebody other than the accused as the killer of Teresa Halbach.
Right. And that's the key point, too, is that one of the challenges, I think, for Kathleen Zellner, as she's tried to delve into and prove what she does in a lot of her wrongful conviction cases, that's one of her strategies, even though I think I just watched a show on Netflix over the weekend where a defense attorney was insisting that lawyers shouldn't spend time trying to find alternative suspects, just prove that their client's not guilty. But
right.
But in Zellner's case and a lot of other lawyers' cases, especially in the wrongful conviction arena, it really is important to try to prove who else could have done it and show that the evidence is much stronger against that other person than the person you're representing. And as you mentioned with Ryan Hilgis and Scott Blodorn, both of them had strong and deep connections to Teresa Halbach, one being a former boyfriend, being Hilgis. Blodorn lived with her at the time that she was missing, and Blodorn didn't immediately report her missing. Hilgis, as people that watched Making a Murderer noticed and talked about at length on social media afterwards, had several scratches on his arms at the time that he was helping organize a lot of these missing person searches for Teresa Halbach. And he also really didn't have a real good explanation to where his whereabouts to at the time that she disappeared. So there was definitely, you know, reason to look at both of those individuals separately as logical suspects, you know, in addition to other people. And like we talked about, both of them took a lead role, an active role in helping organize these searches that were going on to the point where things just also seemed suspicious as far as the discovery of Teresa Halbach's vehicle. The fact that it was found covered with trees and broken pieces of wood. In my mind, Dan, it wasn't to hide the vehicle. It was done to send a signal. It was basically like putting a flag over it and saying, there's 4,000 vehicles at this 40-acre Avery Salvage Yard.
Right.
Here's basically, I can't tell you I'm talking like I'm Sheriff Pagel now, but basically he didn't exactly tell Pam Sturm, or I don't think that he actually would have told Pam Sturm, walk out to the very back part of the property and you'll find it on the left or something like that. It would have been probably conveyed to her by somebody else, possibly along the lines of you'll know it when you see it. And it basically was the only vehicle that was out there that was covered with these odd pieces of trees that, again, if you're Stephen Avery, Dan, or even Brendan Dassey, or the two of them working together, what's the logic in actually covering the murder victim's vehicle with a couple of tree branches and limbs? That doesn't hide anything. It draws attention to it. And that's what happened here. And that's how the vehicle was found. And as we talked about earlier, Tom Sawinski, of all people, newspaper carrier, is seeing Bobby Dassey and a second individual that's not Stephen Avery or Bobby's brother, Brendan, the two individuals convicted of this crime. But he sees two individuals moving this vehicle hours before Pam Sturm and her daughter discover it. Very strange. Very strange.
You had that Kathleen Zellner decides early on to hire the most renowned experts in their fields, in their forensic fields, in ballistics and blood spatter and in all kinds of disciplines, including police procedure and investigation. You talk about that she brought in a person named John DeHaan, and he's a fire and burn expert. Tell us what John DeHaan concluded after looking at the evidence in the burn pit and then the burn barrels and all the evidence that the police reportedly had regarding that.
Yeah, one of the key components, again, at the time of Stephen Avery's original trial, was the sensational notion that Stephen Avery, after supposedly murdering Teresa Halbach inside of his trailer, according to prosecutor Ken Kratz and his story that he had told and shared at a March 2006 wildly sensational press conference. But the story was along the lines that Stephen Avery had tied her up to his bed and raped her and cut her up and then ultimately, supposedly, had taken her body outside, started a bonfire on Halloween night, and that supposedly the fire got 8-10 feet high, and that this would have been Stephen Avery's method, you know, for getting rid of Teresa Halbach and her bones, was to burn her, basically. And that's the story that Ken Kratz used at the trial. It obviously sunk in or carried weight with the jury because they returned a guilty verdict on the murder conviction. I should point out they did not, strangely enough, they found Avery not guilty on the mutilation, which is kind of a weird combination.
Yes.
To find him not guilty and find him guilty of every other charge that he had. But that's an aside. But getting back to your original question with DeHaan is that, yeah, John DeHaan is one of the foremost leading fire and burn experts. And there's not a lot of, you know, murders that involve the dismemberment and burning of bodies, but it does happen enough that we need experts out there that can study this. And DeHaan has that expertise, and that's how Zellner knows of him. So she had him do research, and long story short is that his determination, just knowing the proximity of the properties, knowing the fact that this was, you know, October 31st, this would have been October 31st or with, you know, first part of November, but, you know, with the weather, the outdoor factor here, the proximity to Avery's garage, and that's a rickety garage. I've been out there several times. It was literally looked like if you would sneeze, it would blow over. It was, you know, on the verge of falling apart. Very, very close in proximity to where Stephen Avery's burn pit was, where he would just burn, you know, junk and garbage and other debris, just like everybody else in Wisconsin that lived in a rural setting like that. Nothing nefarious there. And its proximity to, there was also a propane tank that was very close by. So long story short is that John DeHaan came away absolutely convinced that, however, Teresa Halbach was dismembered and her body burned, that it would not have taken place in an outdoor setting, just in a wide open space, such as Stephen Avery's burn pit. And that fact alone contradicts with the fact that some of Teresa Halbach's bones, Dan, were discovered in the neighboring property in one of the burn barrels that Bobby Dassey had, which was, again, several feet away, a good distance between the 2 yards. So if you were of the mindset that Stephen Avery did in fact commit the murder and that he did in fact burn her body in his burn pit, again, it's one of those, how do you reconcile with the rationale that somehow Stephen Avery grabbed some of the bones, but not all the bones, and somehow would have carried some over to his nephew Bobby Dassey's burn barrel and disposed of them in there. So again, it's one of those contradictions of the evidence that's really hard to explain.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. My wife Lisa and I had been talking about our favorite restaurant and one of our favorite meals, seafood risotto. And we thought, how great would it be if we could get that level of delicious meals at home? Cook Unity is the first chef-to-you service, delivering locally sourced meals from award-winning chefs right to your door every week, and cheaper than other delivery options. We ordered meals with a Mediterranean dietary preference. All the meals arrive fresh, never frozen, in packaging that keeps meals fresh in the fridge for up to 7 days. All the meals we ordered were absolutely delicious. Our favorites were the barbecue chicken burrito bowl by Chef Ruben Garcia, chicken, brown rice, corn and black bean salsa, pepper jack cheese, pico de gallo, and pickled jalapenos. Excellent flavor combination, absolutely delicious. Our favorite, though, also by Chef Ruben Garcia, was the sesame salmon with sautéed bok choy, with tamari sauce, a touch of honey, toasted sesame seeds. The salmon dish was amazing. We also really enjoyed Chef Akhtar Noab's beef tinga tacos, braised beef on soft corn tortillas, creamy avocado, and pico de gallo. Cook Unity is a step ahead and a step above any other meal delivery service we've experienced. And it's great to support local chefs and suppliers. There is no cooking required to have chef-quality dining at home. With hundreds of dishes to choose from, with a menu updated constantly, with 7 different dietary options, including vegan, Mediterranean, paleo, gluten-free, and keto, and filters for soy, nut, and dairy options. Pick as few as 4 or as many as 16 meals per week. Experience chef-quality meals every week delivered right to your door. Go to cookunity.com/murder or enter code MURDER before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's 50% off your first week by using code MURDER or going to cookunity.com/murder. Now, you talk about gathering the evidence. You talk about the bones and the theory put forth that Steve Avery killed Teresa Halbach with Brendan Dassey, his nephew. Again, in court, tells the story. It sounds almost unbelievable that Brendan Dassey goes near Stephen Avery's trailer, hears screaming, is not so concerned, but bangs on the door. And then his half-dressed uncle comes to the door and then remarkably invites him in to the torture and rape and eventual murder of Teresa Halbach. The idea, though, that you mentioned that the burn pit had some bones and almost no teeth of Teresa Halbach, but Bobby Dassey's burn barrel had fragments of Teresa Halbach's bones. Let's get to what Kathleen Zellner puts forth as the theory on how Bobby Dassey, Scott Tadich is involved, but how Bobby Dassey is involved, well, how he was involved with the car, when he left the property. Tell us what Kathleen Zellner puts forth as her theory on how this went down.
Well, her theory, Dan, is that Teresa Halbach did do the photo shoot that she was on the Avery property for. Stephen Avery paid her for that, and that she left the property on her own, not having any idea that she was about to be harmed or killed within a matter of several minutes. The belief is that Bobby Dassey was watching her from the window the entire time, basically, and that Bobby Dassey, in fact, in his own vehicle, followed Teresa Halbach, as she left the property, and that probably within a mile or two, could have been shorter, but let's just for sake of discussion, keep it to a mile or two, but somewhere on one of the nearby side roads, either Bobby Dassey pulls over or follows her or, does something to get her attention. But anyway, that she would pull over, he confronts her or has a conversation with her outside as she gets outside the vehicle, and that he harms her by hitting her over the head with an object, not necessarily may have killed her at that point in time, but this may have happened somewhere in the general area that people in Wisconsin are familiar with in this case, a rural road off one of the county highways that's known as Cust Road. And Cust Road is important too, Dan, because at the time of Teresa Halbach's disappearance, prior to Stephen Avery actually being arrested for this murder, several of the police dogs in this case did in fact have several hits, several scent hits for Teresa Halbach in this area of Cuss Road, which again is a couple miles away from the Stephen Avery trailer and also the salvage yard. So there's definite evidence from the dogs, which would have no bias in the case, is important to mention too. But the discovery of Teresa Halbach's scent off of Cuss Road. So again, Zellner to this day will tell you she can't say 100% certainty. That's exactly the way it probably went down. But some of the evidence also points to that possibility, the blood spatter possibility that Halbach was attacked around the same area of the back of her vehicle. And again, that's something else that Stuart James, a bloodstain analysis expert, who's actually been interviewed for two separate books now, but I was familiar with him from a previous book I did. But Stuart James did a lot of blood stain analysis in this case, Dan, and he supported that possibility that Halbach was in fact harmed somewhere around the back of her RAV4 and that's where she was attacked. Again, this would put us a mile or two away from the Stephen Avery property. Now, what's interesting, I want to point this out, is that to remind people that when Bobby Dassey testified at Stephen Avery's trial, he came up with a peculiar story to give himself and his stepfather, his future stepfather, Scott Tadich, both an alibi at the same time. Yeah. He contended that he had left around. I mean, he claimed that he did in fact leave to go deer hunting shortly after Teresa Halbach had left his property, claimed he was unsuccessful, didn't have any luck, but claimed that on his way to go to his deer, the property, he was going to do the deer hunting that afternoon around 3 o'clock or so. And he gets a 50 mile an hour speed limit out there. It's a state highway, 2-lane paved road. But he claimed that while he was going one direction, he saw Scott Tadich going the opposite direction and that they waved at each other and saw each other. And again, that's really important from a lot of standpoints for this case, as I mentioned. Basically, would if you took that story at face value, if you're the police investigators on this case, then that would pretty much rule out the possibility that they had involvement. But at the same time, too, it gives them both, solid alibis as far as around the time frame that one or both of them could have been involved either in the murder or dismemberment or disposal of her vehicle or her body at the same time. So again, it was one of those very, very strange moments in the trial that there's no, you just either take them at their word that they're telling the truth. And if they're not telling the truth, then what other lies have these two individuals put forth about this case? Because that's a big one right there.
It's interesting that a couple things are going on at the same time. If people are fans of the Netflix series Making a Murderer, they'll realize that Avery's attorneys, Buting and Strang, put forth that police officers in Montauk County had planted blood in the RAV4. But Zellner is saying that there are two things going on at the same time. Of course, the county is afraid of the $36 million lawsuit that's going to basically bankrupt them, and the legacy of that law enforcement would be tarnished forever. And unique to the state to have that kind of expose in front of the public, especially with the Making a Murderer Netflix series and its popularity throughout the world. But there are a couple things going on at the same time in terms of that RAV4 being on Stephen Avery's property ultimately. But as you write, that there is evidence that this was some manipulation and chicanery going on at the county gravel pit, which is nearby Avery's property. Can you explain?
Right. That's one of those key components of the case that really was brushed aside and really underplayed at the time of Stephen Avery's trial. The fact is that that's that gravel pit and that, there's two gravel pits, they kind of overlap each other out there. One belonged to the family of Josh Redant, and the other one was actually Mantua County government property. But again, that's where a lot of the police officers were actually doing a lot of their investigation at the time of Teresa Halbach's disappearance. Even as Stephen Avery had emerged, or some of them had already zeroed in on Stephen Avery as the person that they were hoping to convict or arrest for this crime, the fact is that they were spending considerable resources away from the actual Stephen Avery's trailer and the areas where Kent Crass is going to focus when it goes to trial. But they were spending their time, like I mentioned earlier, in this area of Cuss Road. And then also, as you'd point out, Dan, on the county gravel pit properties. And it was at those gravel pit properties where, again, more bones were found, including what was probably, you know, believed to be Teresa Halbach's pelvic bones were found out there. So that strongly raises the possibility that that location, I'm talking about the county gravel pit properties, Dan, but that those gravel pits were the area where Teresa Halbach's body was incinerated, probably inside of a burn barrel pit. Again, possibly the Bobby Dassey burn barrel, if in fact he had driven that thing back with one of his family's golf carts, RAV4s, probably one of the golf carts, actually. The golf cart came up in discussion, and the police dogs were also getting, you know, some hits off of that. So as my conversations I've had with Zellner about this topic, Dan, she believes that that's a strong possibility, is that one or more burn barrels could have been loaded up, taken out to the quarry. And again, that quarry in that time of the year, end of October, beginning of November, there's not going to be very many, if any, people that are out there. So that would have been a location, a prime location, if you're familiar with that area, that would have been a safe location if you're the killer to feel comfortable that nobody's going to see you or spot you or suspect you, you know, if you had a burn barrel out there and your purpose was to dispose, incinerate a human body, somebody that you had already killed. So again, that county court property could have been what the area where, in fact, Teresa Halbach's bones were ultimately burned and destroyed.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, you spoke to Kathleen Zellner in September 29th, 2023 in Naperville. And you also talk about that nobody wants in Wisconsin a Making a Murderer season 3. Tell us about your talk with Kathleen Zellner. Tell us more.
Well, I mean, that's a key factor that's on her mind and that she's kind of felt strongly, Dan, that one of the reasons why a lot of these post-conviction decisions from Judge Angela Sukowitz seem like they're constantly going against her, in spite of all the evidence that Zellner has come up with, looking, pointing at an alternative suspect. Any suspect is what you need, what they're called. And in order to be successful in court, prove that somebody else had motive and strong possibility to, in fact, be the killer. In fact, even though she's uncovered strong evidence pointing to Bobby Dassey as a possibility, and also uncovering considerable evidence that was withheld from Stephen Avery and his original lawyers, Dean Strang and Jerry Buting, by the prosecution and the police. In spite of all that, she's been unsuccessful in getting a new trial or getting a new hearing just for Avery. And so one of the reasons why she thinks that that's probably happened here, unlike her other successful cases over the years, is that the Wisconsin political arena, Democrats and Republicans, it seems, but just elected officials, do not want to endure another 10-episode season that'll bring more notoriety and bad press and publicity to the state of Wisconsin and its criminal justice system, as happened as a result of Making a Murder season 1 in December of 2015, and then season 2 in October of 2018. And the best way, from a strategy standpoint, Zellner's figured this out, is that if Wisconsin's judges and politicians are able to keep her and Stephen Avery unsuccessful, that limits the opportunity for a third season, because there's really not much for the producers and the filmmakers to go with at this point in time. So much of the story, you know, has been told, and that's even true on my end, you know, as far as writing a book is concerned. So that's where Zellner's kind of felt that the fact that Stephen Avery's case, although it's really helped her from a standpoint of shining a light on injustice and also fairness and professionalism, Wisconsin's criminal justice system, the negative has been just the fact that Stephen Avery's case is basically so toxic as far as the Wisconsin judges are concerned. They're too scared or too timid to actually go against the grain and make a decision that would really make other judges and other people before them look bad by giving Zellner and Stephen Avery another day in court. As so many convicted criminals throughout North America, especially here in the United States, get time and time again for way, 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 way less technicalities. And in this case, as Zellner believes she's proven, she can point to another logical suspect with strong evidence, circumstantial evidence, that he feels wasn't available back in 2007 when Stephen Avery had his original trial. And therefore, he deserves a new trial where she can put on that evidence and let a jury decide whether or not Stephen Avery should be found guilty or innocent of Teresa Halbach's murder under these better circumstances for her and him.
You talk about Judge Sutkiewicz and basically the news that she asked to be off the case finally, and there was a new judge assigned. So there is some optimism that at least she's not there anymore. He said she was a terrible jurist. So there's a new judge, and so there's some optimism. And in fact, Kathleen Zellner is not one to give up and says she won't give up till he is freed from prison. But she says that she's very confident that somebody will look at this and grant another trial, because she says that Judge Sutkiewicz did a number of egregious errors, including believing that incorrectly that there was not bones in Bobby Dassey's burn barrel, and exclusively all the bones were in the burn pit.
So burn pit and she got it wrong. She even, I think, said even in a burn barrel at Stephen Avery's, which Stephen Avery did have a burn barrel that was near his property, and there were none of Teresa Halbach's bones were discovered in that. So I would just, that's one of those head scratchers to me, that if I'm a judge on a case that I already know ahead of time has gotten worldwide attention, that would make me even more, I was going to say paranoid, but just cautious is probably the better word, Dan, that I'm going to get it right as far as just what the basic important evidentiary facts of the case are. And here we are in August of 2023, 18 years after the homicide originally happened, but about 10 years or so that she's been on the case, and she's still getting key evidentiary facts wrong. That, and by doing it that way, it's really further pointing the evidence against Stephen Avery rather than at someone else or an alternate suspect, which is the way that that evidence unbiasedly or objectively looked. It's one of those things that makes me wonder if she was just sloppy the whole time, or just kind of looked at this case as, yeah, I just got stuck with this and I have to deal with it, and I don't want to upset anybody, so I'm going to status quo this case as best I can. And when I read her opinion from this past August, where she rejected basically all the Tom Suwinski information, yes, and evidence, where she basically is saying that, yeah, okay, I'll take it, you know, as a matter of fact, that Tom Suwinski did see Bobby Dassey and a second person pushing the vehicle. But from Judge Sutkiewicz's writing and her opinion, she came back and said, well, okay, well, that doesn't prove that he actually, you know, had the keys to her vehicle. That doesn't actually prove that he was driving her vehicle. But Dan, we're talking about, it's the murder victim's vehicle. So if Bobby Dassey, what in the world would be, why would he even be handling, pushing around the vehicle of a missing woman that we're going to later discover had been murdered and dismembered? So, you know, why in the world would he be handling it? It was just really strange and goofy. And I don't want to go off on too many tangents, but I will point out that Judge Sutkiewicz in August also pointed to Brendan Dassey, Bobby Dassey's brother, the one that's condemned,
yes,
that is also convicted, probably even more wrongfully. So people in, you know, wrongful conviction movement believe in the case. But Judge Sutkiewicz cited Brendan Dassey's supposed confession as further evidence to back up her reason for rejecting the Tom Suwinski affidavit and also the evidence pointing to Bobby Dassey as the killer. So it was just for Zellner and certainly for her supporters and fans, and definitely I'm sure for Stephen Avery, it was very deflating to get that August ruling after several years of really working hard to dig into this Tom Suwinski information now pointing to Bobby Dassey. And then lo and behold, out of nowhere, it even surprised me as I was working on the book, Dan, we get this notice that Angela Sutkiewicz, Judge Sutkiewicz, has given up the case and that she's no longer going to handle Stephen Avery from here on out. So we didn't know for about a week or two it was going to happen, where what judge was going to handle the case. And lo and behold, Dan, the case got assigned to a brand new judge. And I say brand new, I mean it that way. He had just gotten elected a judge back in April of last year. So brand new judge. It was a brand new position that the courts had created in Wisconsin because of Manitowoc County's growth and caseload numbers for the other judges. So this brand new judge, Anthony Lambrick, I believe is how you say his name, but yeah, he had previously worked as a police officer for about 6 years. Then he became a lawyer and worked for several years as a public defender. So he has represented indigent people, and he has represented people trying to, you know, fight the system or prove their innocence. And then in most recent years, he was working as a prosecutor as an assistant district attorney for Manitowoc County. So Zellner, Kathleen Zellner is very optimistic that at least she feels that she's got a judge now on the case that really is not politically connected, Dan, or beholden to people that have a deep interest in a stake in the outcome of Stephen Avery's conviction and Brendan Dassey's conviction. So time will tell. If we have this conversation again a year or two from now, be in a better position to tell you, you know how things turned out. But for now, Kathleen Zellner feels optimistic that hopefully this judge will give her and Stephen Avery a fair shake when it comes to examining and weighing the new evidence and information that she and her team of investigators and team of world-renowned experts have uncovered that looks at the strong possibility that the version of events that were presented in 2007 at Stephen Avery's trial were not the real facts as far as how Teresa Halbach met her death, who killed her, and where, in fact, she was dismembered. And we'll see where things go.
Very interesting when you posited that if you imagine the $36 million lawsuit and its ramifications and damage to the legacy of law enforcement in Wisconsin, they were on the verge of that when they made the arrest of Stephen Avery and when they had this treasure trove of convenient evidence, it seemed. But you say, can you imagine the fallout, the ramifications, the incredible lawsuit number if he was wrongfully convicted again? You imagine. So there is a lot of forces, it seems to be, in Wisconsin, from bringing in investigators that were in retirement. It just seems there's a lot of people with a vested interest in not having Stephen Avery get out of jail anytime soon.
Right. And that's kind of the way that, like I said, Zellner had felt that it was going, as the more she had worked hard uncovering evidence or information that pointed to Stephen Avery's innocence and or also pointed to alternative suspects and also uncovered evidence for what we call here in America is Brady violations, which is where the prosecution is accused or determined to have withheld information that would have been favorable for the defense, things such as other evidence or other witnesses. And we know factually that happened on several occasions here where Stephen Avery's lawyers were not presented with information or evidence, including this Tom Sawinski phone call where he had, in fact, made a phone call to the Manitowoc Sheriff's Office within days of Teresa Halbach disappearing, calling them to let them know that he had discovered two individuals pushing the vehicle. And that guy was blown off. He was not taken seriously, nor did anybody follow up on that and by the Manitowoc Sheriff's Office. And then there's no report on that. So in Stephen Avery's defense and or his lawyer's defense, they didn't even know about that information. And that's, you know, I hate to use the word bombshell because that's a cliche, but that certainly would have been very helpful then and advantageous from a defense strategy, if Dean Strang and Jerry Buting, the original lawyers, would have known that somebody else was in fact pushing Teresa Halbach's vehicle within 5 or 6 hours of it actually being discovered on the Avery Salvage property on November, you know, in November of 2005.
You also talk about a possible Brady violation, or she claims it's a Brady violation. The CD, the computer files that were found on the Dassey computer where Barb had taken to a technician and there were segments or portions of it erased. But right from the beginning, the police trying to portray the computer as Brendan's when in fact it was Bobby's. And then Kathleen Zellner did the forensic evidence to say that he was lying at trial, saying he was sleeping when he was accessing that computer for very violent pornography topics and images before Teresa Halbach came to the property all during that morning. So her assessment is that CD that would have been very damaging, those files would have been very damaging to the narrative of Ken Kratz, and as a result, withheld that information. One of the files or some of the folders that were very, very incriminating were withheld from Buting and Strang at Stephen Avery's trial.
Right. And the other key point about that too, Dan, is that even if Dean Strang and Jerry Buting, Stephen Avery's lawyers, would have had access and knowledge of that, they certainly would have been able to question and hammer away at Bobby Dassey's testimony where he claimed that he had been sleeping basically all day and then basically woke up, took a shower, and decided to go hunting. They would have been able to prove that he'd been on the computer for several hours that day and certainly smashed holes into his testimony. And with then on top of that, obviously get into the whole disturbing images and the keyword searches that he had been undertaking. The fact his mom then would hire computer technicians to remove and erase certain time frames of his activities on the computer. So the police or anybody would have never been able to access that. He had folders created for, there was a Teresa Halbach folder that was created. I think I mentioned the other one was called DNA Dan, like
yes.
DNA. And then I think a third one was, you know, Stephen Avery, but certainly Halbach and DNA. And it's, you know, again, it's like now Gary Hunt, Kathleen Zellner's, you know, world-renowned computer expert pointed out in his affidavit that he himself was not able to determine the time frame, you know, when the folders actually were created. But again, the fact that there was so much erasing done to the computer around the time frame that Teresa Halbach had been visiting, you know, and already going to the Avery Salvage Yard property over several occasions to the several days after her disappearing and the police investigation into her disappearance and murder certainly raised strong possibilities that Bobby Dassey may have had something to do with it. Otherwise, why in the world would these files be turning up missing? And why would his family go to these lengths that they did to erase and destroy this information that was, in fact, on the computer? And as you point out, and I'm glad you did, the police wrongfully tried to portray this family computer as being his other brother, Brendan Dassey's computer, when in fact, Bobby was the one that that used it. And other family members have given affidavits backing up Zellner, you know, and supporting her and pointing that out, that Bobby Dassey was the one that was pretty much home all the time using the computer. And while there were, in fact, other Dassey siblings living at the house, Bobby was the one that pretty much used that computer. And he's the only one that really everything could point back to.
At the end of your book, you, in the epilogue, you get to talk to Stephen Avery or through Kathleen Zellner. She tells Stephen Avery of your book and asks him a few questions. Before I let you go, there is a little bit of information that Stephen Avery discusses in that phone call involving his brothers. And again, right to the very end of this book, exposing new information and new leads in this investigation.
The one thing about Stephen Avery is that he does in fact point out, and I know people that are really strongly supportive of Brendan Dassey, you know, his innocence. Stephen, believing in his own innocence, basically says that he doesn't know whether in fact Brendan's innocent or whether in fact maybe that Brendan could have possibly helped Bobby Dassey. But Stephen Avery does reveal that he believes, you know, with 100% certainty that Bobby Dassey is the one that he's always believed and strongly believes was responsible for Teresa Halbach's demise. And he even pointed out to me, too, that he knew that Bobby had a history of lying and, you know, and even talked about some situations where, you know, where Bobby was taking parts from a lot of the, you know, the junk vehicles, the scrap, you know, from the scrapyard at the Avery's salvage yard, the massive salvage yard, and selling those off to people he knew through school, but denied that he did it and that kind of stuff. So Stephen already believes that Bobby Dassey has a strong history of lying and would do anything to get himself out of a jam and get himself out of trouble, especially, you know, in a murder case. So yeah, it was revealing that the fact that you'd have family feel that strongly against other family members. But Stephen Avery has had, 18 years now. Since 2005, 18 years that he's been accused or incarcerated for Teresa Halbach's murder. So he's had a lot of time. 18 years too, Dan, is how much time he spent for the first case. He was wrongfully convicted for the rape that happened in 85, and he was let out in 2003. That's interesting. So he's had 18 years times two now to sit back and stew, and he's had plenty of time to think about it. And he feels strongly that Bobby, his nephew, Bobby Dassey, is the person that appears to be most likely responsible for Teresa Halbach's disappearance and killing.
Yes, it's a fascinating and incredible story, and it's why it's captivated audiences throughout the world and will continue, I'm sure, with Kathleen Zellner at the helm and with your fine book, Wrecking Crew. I want to thank you very much, John, for coming on and talking about your updated Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery, the updated 5th anniversary edition, including an exclusive interview with Steve Avery. Thank you very much for this interview, John Ferrick. And for those of people that might want to take further look at your work, this book and your other work, where might they go?
I would let people know that please visit my book publisher, Colorado-based Wild Blue Press. So wildbluepress.com. They're very active also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter especially. And Amazon is also one of the easiest places to find any and all of my books, including Wrecking Crew. The Audible book that is narrated by Kevin Pierce is also out as well. So I would encourage people on the audio side to give that a listen. And lastly, johnferrick.com is also another place to take a look at Wrecking Crew and or all of my other true crime books over the years.
Thank you very much, John Ferrick, for coming on and talking about Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery. Thank you very much for this interview, and you have a great evening and good night.
Thank you very much, Dan. Always a pleasure. Appreciate it. Good night.
Thank you.